We are going to be finishing up some things from chapter 1 that will take us very nicely into chapter 2. If you look at the end, or toward the end of chapter 1, let's see, this is verse 21, but St. Paul has a, you know, if this were one of our students turning it in, we would call it a run-on sentence, but since St. Paul is an inspired writer, we will not call it a run-on sentence. But in talking about God's power, which he accomplished in Christ when he raised him from the dead, made him sit at the right hand in heavenly places, far above all rule and authority, power and dominion, above every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the age to come. Okay? And church fathers, such as St. Gregory the Great, would see in this, we are being told, we are being given more information about the angels, and in particular about the angelic hierarchy. And if you went to Catholic school once upon a time in the old days, it could be that Sister Mary Immaculata had you memorize the angelic hierarchies. Had to do a lot more memorization in those days, fruits of the Holy Spirit and commandments of the Church, and that stuff was just sort of written on your soul after a while. So what I've done is listed those angelic, each of them are called choirs, I'll explain that in just a bit, from highest to lowest. And these are terms that are throughout Scripture, and then eventually they get organized like this by early writers in the church, the folks that we refer to as church fathers. So seraphim at the top, cherubim. Seraphim is a term that occurs, we get that name from Isaiah. Remember in Isaiah 6, when he has this vision of God, and the seraphim are around the heavenly throne, and they are calling to each other. Remember what they're calling out to each other? Holy, holy, holy. So this has become a part of the liturgy, this cry that the seraphim are making to each other. And seraphim, as the name seraph, has the implication of burning or fire. And so they've always been associated with, in the Christian tradition, with that somehow they excel in love of God. They are at the top, and their excellence is this love that they have, which is this flaming love. By the way, the thing about holy, 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 it's important to remember. For us, when you want to put something in the superlative, you just put like most or best. If you're Latin, you know, you have isimus or isima. But in many languages, including Hebrew, you say it, if it's better, then you say the word twice, and if it's best, you say it three times. So holy, holy, holy isn't the angels being repetitive. They are saying most holy. That holy, holy, holy amounts to a superlative. Go ahead.
Just before the Torah is read in every synagogue, we raise ourselves, like you're standing with your feet flat, and you raise yourself up to your toes, and we do that three times, and we say, holy, 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 art thou, O Lord, our God.
Right. And again, the idea isn't just, hey, if we say it enough times, then, you know, it'll take. No, it's that you are, this is the way of saying most holy, highest in holiness. Next, cherubim. Of course, cherubim, that name is right in Genesis. Remember, there's the cherubim with the flaming sword that after Adam and Eve are expelled. But the cherubim appear later in Ezekiel, in the opening chapter of Ezekiel, and then chapter 10, in the middle of chapter 10. And pretty much, you know, for angels' names, you'll notice the rest of these: thrones, dominations, virtues, powers, principalities. Thrones is used uniquely in Colossians, then Ephesians and Colossians use these: dominations, virtues, powers, principalities. Archangels is used in Jude, remember, Jude just has one chapter, so verse 9, letter of Jude. And then, of course, the term angel is used all over the place. Okay, so notice that most of these terms are coming from the New Testament. We have these kind of key, these higher or highest angelic orders that we get their names in the Old Testament. But the Old Testament gives us angels in a very veiled way. They seem very human. Remember, when angels appear in the Old Testament, they just appear like human beings. And their angelic power becomes a little more evident as time goes on. So think about the book of Daniel. Daniel, you know you're not just dealing with something that's kind of human-like anymore. And then by the time you get into the New Testament, angels, you're getting more information about them, and now you're getting more information about devils. You know, the devil appears very briefly in the Old Testament, right? He appears in the book of Job, and that's the first time that he appears in his proper person. You know, looking back, we know that the serpent that's talking to Eve is the devil. But that's not, you know, that you wouldn't get that just from reading the book. You wouldn't get that just from reading Genesis. That's newer information that we have that now reading back. Satan doesn't appear as Satan, you know, until the book of Job, until later in the Old Testament. And that's something that makes sense. Remember, you're with the Israelites, you are trying to drive home that there is one God. There aren't all these dozens and dozens of gods that you have in these polytheistic religions, like the Egyptian religion, the Canaanite religion, that they're surrounded by. You are not helping things by saying, oh, by the way, there are all these spiritual beings out there too that you would easily mistake for God. So there has to be clarity that you're getting about the oneness of God. You've got to have that down before it's safe to give more information about the angels. So if you wonder, well, why isn't this toward the beginning? In fact, why in the creation account aren't we just told about the angels up front? That's why. You have to have the recipients of Revelation firmly understand the unity of God before they understand that there are other spiritual beings below Him. Go ahead.
How high of an angel, then, do you think Satan was?
We don't know, but when you read... let's say Isaiah, and Isaiah, I think 24 is where it talks about, O day star, how you have ascended on high. You know, day star, when you put that in Latin, is Lucifer, right? The star Venus, when it rises in the morning, the Romans would call that Lucifer, the light bearer. And then when it sets in the evening, it's called Vespers. Historically, Isaiah is talking about Cyrus. He's talking about this Persian prince. But then afterwards, that's always associated with the devil. That somehow, so that you call him Daystar, that he falls through pride. You know, that's a reason to think that you're talking about an angel from a very high order indeed, maybe the highest. Okay? But we don't, that those kinds of details are generally not revealed to us. There's educated theological guessing, but you know, by very wise and holy people. But that's the kind of thing. This is the other thing to say about, you know, the information we get on the angels. Now in the military, there are things that you're told, we're going to let you know on a need-to-know basis. And that's how you have to think about the information that you get about spirits and about the creation of the world. I mean, when you think about the creation, it's pretty much three chapters. Creation and fall is three chapters. Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat is 13 chapters. For many of us, we would want 13 chapters on the creation. And three chapters on Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat would be quite enough, thank you. But evidently, God in his wisdom thinks that it's more important for us to know that in detail than know about creation in detail. There are things about the creation, about spirits, that really are wonderful. That is, wonderful in the sense that they appeal to our natural knowledge of wanting to understand the universe and how it works and where it came from. But unfortunately, such is the human condition. There are things about it which really just excite our curiosity. We use the words wonder and curiosity interchangeably. In traditionally in the church, those were not interchangeable terms. Curiosity is the itch to know. It's wanting to know things that perhaps are not right for you to know or none of your business. So when me and my middle school friends were at the bookstore and there was like High Times magazine and all sorts of other magazines I could think of that we just sort of wanted to, like, what's going on in there? That's curiosity. Okay. When I give the example to students, I'll say that someone gets expelled. What did they get expelled for? That's curiosity. That is not going to help you, help your mind, help you understand the world. That's just the itch to know. And unfortunately, we can have that same itch when it comes to the angels. These aren't things that are really helpful or edifying for us to know. In my public high school, there were two books that were always checked out from the library. One was the Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll, and the other was the Encyclopedia of Witchcraft and Demonology. Why my public school had an Encyclopedia of Witchcraft and Demonology on the shelf, I have no idea. But that wasn't from wonder. That wasn't from, I want to understand the universe in which I live. That's the itch to know. So even though this may be frustrating to us, you have to understand that God's judgment about this is we are being told the things that we need to know. And to pursue it further a lot more often than not is just not going to be helpful for us. Now, I used the term earlier, choir. When we think choir, we think of people all lined up together, right, singing. And you don't think choir in that sense. Think of the older meaning of the term, like choreography. What's choreography? Dancing. So choros in ancient Greece may have meant people who were singing, but more often it meant people who were dancing. So when you think of choirs, it's like you think of something where they're like in movement, and there's this organized and ordered movement. So when you think of choirs of angels, that somehow, like a dance, they have these patterns that are being executed because they, in some way, oversee the material creation. In other words, angels oversee spiritual things, and that's what we customarily think of. But when you read a St. Augustine or a St. Thomas, they will talk about angels also overseeing the natural world in some way. So there are all sorts of things I could appeal to, but let me use an easy one. It should not, unless you're just a hardcore rock rib Christian fundamentalist young earther, you've accepted that over millions of years there's some kind of development among organic beings from simpler forms to perhaps more complex ones. Okay, and but the problem is we're stuck with a scientific theory that talks about that development in terms of physical laws and chance. Okay, so somehow we get these accidental changes that over time add up to new organisms. The difficulty is once you look, just sit down with BBC Earth or BBC Life or BBC Planet Earth Part 1 and Part 2. Watch any nature documentary, 50-minute documentary through, and as they're describing animals in their habitat and what animals have to survive, and you're going to just keep coming to this basic problem. This animal is not going to make it. This poison dart frog or this hummingbird or this Komodo dragon is not going to make it unless it has everything that it has right now. How do these partially adapted, partially developed, partially mutated animals make it such that they now competitively survive and pass on their genes? I was watching one of these documentaries with my boys in house, and I didn't say anything. I was just kind of enjoying it. And about halfway through, one of the boys remarks, it was about insects. And it was about this beetle that it eats ants, it gets their formic acid, and then it's able to shoot that formic acid at enemies. You know, so this mongoose is trying to go after this beetle, right, sprays it with this formic acid. And this boy just says, how do you develop that? How do you get that like step by step? You know, how, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing to ask. So when you read people such as St. Augustine and St. Thomas, they have no objection to there being some kind of development over time with regard to animals. But what they would say is, if you're seeing that animals are developing in a way that it's intelligent, in other words, you're getting new body plans and you're getting new this and new that and they all work, that is angelic oversight. In other words, that is angels working with genetic material that's already there and drawing things out of that genetic material. Okay, and remember, you've already bought into human beings in some way being drawn out of mud. So it shouldn't be too much of a deal to have, you know, angels now being able to draw things, genetic possibilities out of what's already there. Go ahead, Ms. Bettina.
I find that confusing because I mean, God created it. God laid that the ground for organisms to be able to thrive and function and develop. So adding the angels as oversight to me is confusing to me.
Does God create every new species that comes into existence?
Yes.
That I think, is essentially what Darwin successfully argues against. I would say Darwin actually makes a good case for that. So that is what we call special creationism.
But the angels would oversee that.
Let me just say briefly. The thing that Darwin successfully does, I don't buy into Darwin's whole case, but the case that works, and you can see it in his book on orchids. When you look at orchids and their relationship to other flowers, you can see that there are these earlier things that in later stages have these things that we now describe as orchids. And what Darwin argues is this: if it's a special creation, if God is just making it totally from nothing, then why is there a structure and shape relationship over time? If it were just a... In other words, when you picture God creating, this is what I'll ask students. Do you picture, like, there's a plane on the Serengeti and then, boom, gazelles? You know? Do you picture a plane on the Serengeti, boom, you know, jaguars? If you're having some kind of genetic relationship, if there's some kind of traceable relationship in body forms and body shapes and so on, that you can see that... there are these things that they're not quite spiders, but they're spider-like. They're really big. I forget what they're called again. But then later forms, you have what you have. Are you committed to saying one just sort of, if you like, disappears and then boop, right, one?
No, I see your point there, but this is a whole new concept I've never heard before of angels overseeing, yep. Overseeing.
You're right. Religion. You're right. It is brand new. I mean, it's brand new in the sense that you're hearing it. You're right. No. I mean, it's brand new in the sense that nobody talks about it anymore. You're right. Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about angelic oversight of nature, it is a common thing in the fathers. It is a common thing in the doctors. But then once you get into the modern world, it becomes materialistic. In other words, matter is a real cause and spirit is not a cause. Or spirit is imaginary. Or spirit is something that we project because we're trying to protect morality or allow people to live together. And even with our students, you know, even in a Catholic school, it is so hard not to compartmentalize. Okay, there's science class. And science class is experiments and physical laws and genetics and things. And I'm in religion class. And that's about being a good person and praying and God's my happiness and the source of my life and so on. And so when you start trying to talk to 16-year-olds, as happens in Mere Christianity, about how God is... the opening of Mere Christianity is right and wrong is a clue to the meaning of the universe. And when Lewis moves from the moral law showing there's a God to, well, he must be directing not just us. God must be directing plants and rocks and animals and so on. Ms. Bettina, they find that so confusing. Because they don't think of God directing anything except for human beings. In other words, religion is just, and theology is just sort of God and me. But like the whole rest of the universe runs like some kind of mathematical machine that has no relationship to God at all. And the reason that I think it's worth emphasizing the angels here, if the angels, I mean, that role that the angels have means that there's this sort of natural connection between the natural and the supernatural. That in some way the natural is linked up with what it is that spirits do. If we abolish that, then we really are into this realm of creationism, in the sense that only God works with nature, and maybe he just works at the beginning, winds the thing up, and then after that, there's kind of no divine relationship at all. Go ahead.
But if someone has a hard time seeing God's hand in creation, how are they going to see an angel's hand in creation? It's the same...
Oh, it might be a similar...
...between science and...
But notice, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying to you, that I agree that we don't think of angels doing this, but the same thing goes on with God. We don't think of God doing it either. You're right. It's kind of easier to think of God doing it. But that's what I'm trying to say. We've lost that too. But to put it more clearly, to believe that God is in charge, eventually for that to really make sense, you're going to have to bring in angels too. In other words, you can't have a system where, for example, St. Thomas will say, and he's not saying this on his own, this is a long tradition of the Church Fathers, every good suggestion that you have, or every good idea that you have, begins with the suggestion of your guardian angel. In other words, all of us have angels that are with us suggesting good things to do. So when you say things like, well, God told me this or God told me that, it's not that God doesn't tell you, but God is always telling you through the mediacy of your angel. Okay? Or put it this way, more often than not. Okay? So, and if you, no, I want a direct line to God. I don't want my angel telling me things. Well, look, people receive the faith because the apostles bring it to them. They don't say, no, I'm waiting for miraculous visions from God. I don't want mere human beings bringing me the faith. It doesn't work that way. God has a whole universe of created things, and he is going to reach you through those created things. Some number of those created beings are going to reach you, are just going to be your natural things like rocks and trees and animals. There may be things about that sort of elicit a spiritual awakening for you. Some number of those created things are going to be human. They're going to be people who have the faith, or maybe even people who don't have the faith, who somehow say things or trigger things to you. That again, this is God revealing himself to you, guiding you, telling you which way to go. And then some number of ways in which God is going to be speaking to you is through your guardian angel. You know, what's the point of giving you a spiritual being who has been there from your birth to your death if he isn't somehow going to be significant as being kind of God's mouthpiece? When you look at the Old Testament, St. Paul reflecting on the Old Law, we'll talk about how the law was given to us through the ministry of angels. Okay, that's the way Paul talks. So when you think of the burning bush, you know, there are many church fathers that will talk quite comfortably about that being an angel speaking to Moses. You know, that he is, or think of the way in which the Israelites are guided by God. Yes, they're guided by God, but they're guided by a pillar of fire at night, a pillar of smoke by day. That's angelic activity. And in fact, he says, I will send my angel before you. Right? I will send my angel before you. So, again, it's like we've reduced the role. In fact, to the extent that like modern Christians can picture angels, it's almost nothing. I mean, it sounds melancholy to say this, but it's almost nothing better than Michael Landon in Highway to Hell, or Highway to Heaven. Highway to Hell is what we always used to call it when I was a kid. And or Touched by an Angel, where angels are therapists. Angels go around and they sort of listen to your emotions or help you reconcile with this bad relationship you have with your father or something like this. No, if you've got these spiritual beings, they're not just Dr. Phil. You know, these are beings that are going to be regulating things, not just for your psychological health, but your spiritual, your moral health. And why wouldn't they be permeating the whole of nature? Do we really think of nature as just a kind of a machine that God winds up and lets run? Yeah, go ahead.
So I was reading Ephesians 3.
Yeah.
Thinking that, but so they're talking about the principalities and the powers,
yep,
their role. But what it says in here is St. Paul doesn't say anything about whether these powers are good or evil. What he does reassert very clearly is Christ's supremacy over all these powers, which,
yep,
we know, right? And the church's role in bringing all creation to recognize that Christ is Lord of all. But here's the interesting part. Therefore, the powers in the heavenly places no longer have any mastery over the Christian. Through faith in Christ, the Christian acquires the freedom of a son of God and is able to address God confidently.
Sure. So let's take that. When you look at the beginning, you read that from 3, you were saying from 3?
Yeah, 3, 10 through 12.
Well, let's look at 2 first. He made you alive when you were dead through the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of the world, following the prince of the power of air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience. Mm-hmm. That is the devil.
Mm-hmm, right.
Okay, that is the devil. So we're not talking about the good angels. Please remember in John, in the Gospel of John, 3 different times our Lord will refer to the devil, refer to Satan as the prince of this world. And especially for our younger people, that's startling to hear. And it's funny because it shows the kind of dichotomy they live in. Because you point out to them, well, when you look at newspapers or websites or movies or news, or is it your impression that all that is about promoting Jesus as Lord? Oh, and of course they just laugh. Okay. Well, as the poet once said, you got to serve somebody. It may be the devil, it may be the Lord, but you got to serve somebody. And so if those things are not subordinate, right, to the direction of Christ, or are not even open to it, then it's coming from the other direction. Okay? Lewis, in Mere Christianity, when he introduces the incarnation, that chapter is called The Invasion. And the idea is that when Christ is born, he is invading enemy-held territory. So when you talk about the prince whose authority of this air, and how these things that you know that I point out to the students, it's in the very language of St. Paul. The fashion of the world, the desires of the flesh. You know, that's where the devil has his hold. So more often than not, the things that we consider fashionable, trending, right? Piety and holiness, trending. No, and by the way, it was never true. Even in earlier ages of faith, there was certainly more pressure to be faithful. But when you pick up Geoffrey Chaucer, when you pick up Boccaccio's Decameron, when you pick up these things from the Middle Ages, their culture is saturated from the faith with the faith. But there are still people who are holy and people who are wicked, people who are reverent in their speech and people who are completely obscene in their speech. It's still a world in which people can cooperate with the message of God or not. So in other words, it isn't just that we live in a secular time and that's why it's an issue for us. Even if we lived in the Middle Ages, there would be still ways in which there would be things that were fashionable that were a problem, that were bad, that were taking us away from the faith we should be living. There are still going to be those desires of the flesh. Not just desires of the flesh, gluttony, lust, but greed, envy, anger, using that term broadly. There are still those things that are going to be afflicting the human race. And insofar as we are being held by those things, then that's a beachhead the devil has. That's the way that he has control. So when you see this reference to being free from the spirits of the air, they're not talking about the angels, right? They're talking about the fallen angels. They're talking about the wicked angels. And that what Christ has made possible for us is that we live this way of life that we know to be right. I wanted to touch on these words that you see especially in 2, where it will talk about, let me check this translation. Yes, citizens. That if you look at verse 19, you are no longer strangers and sojourners, but you are fellow citizens with the saints, members of the household of God. So you think about that contrast, you know, being a stranger or guest versus being a citizen or a member of the household. And there are ways in which being a Christian is like being part of a household. There's a way in which it's like being part of a city or part of a political entity. So if you think about the household part, that you call God Father, and that you picture that there are many mansions and that our Father has prepared, right? You're thinking of that in a very kind of homely way. Cardinal Newman, when he was a preacher at St. Mary's, Oxford, he has this lovely sermon where it's called "The Church, a Home for the Lonely," and he talks about how it is that that the world offers us all these things which don't fully satisfy, and so therefore they never really give us rest. That the world, as it were, you know, agitates us and tosses us around, and the church should be a place which is, in a way, like a home. Like the way that at the end of the day, you know, with your business, you come home and you're home and hypothetically, you get to rest. Actually, you just start working again. But at some point, you actually do stop working and you get to sit in your own chair or your own bed with your own books in your own place and sort of recover yourself. Okay, and it might be the case that you're in a parish that's just a very active parish and a busy parish and doesn't feel that way. Or it's a kind of a divided parish and there's all sorts of friction going on so it doesn't feel that way. But, you know, ideally that's what the church should be. Because what it offers is the thing that is the only thing that ultimately is going to give you peace. What it offers is the only thing that sort of in a lasting way can give you that sort of refuge. Yeah, go ahead.
How is the saint defined in those at that time?
Yeah, so you'll notice, by the way, this is one of the things, and we can talk about this more, I'll just have to say this briefly, but when St. Paul talks about Christians and the Christian life, he will very easily talk about not just there being people who have gone before who are saints, the way we tend to talk, but that to be a Christian is to be a saint. Now, our picture in the modern world, now 2,000 years later, is we think of saint as like this special status, and then there's just kind of us, you know, bums down here, and maybe we're sort of better on some days than others. But I'll just say this briefly, but it's worth enlargement on its own. Again, this is a point that's drawn out by Newman when he talks about it. It's a sermon that's called "Religion: A New Nature," and in this sermon, he says that when you read the letters of St. Paul, St. Peter, St. John, they all seem to speak as if the Christian life were a life that is free from sin. There is no picture in the epistles of somehow a Christian falling into serious sin. It's very you see it in Ephesians, where he addresses Christians as if this was your past life, this was your life, a life of sin, a life of worldliness, a life of enslavement. This is your life now, a life of sanctity, a life of holiness. Okay, and for us, especially in an age that's a religiously lax age. You know, if earlier Catholic ages may have been scrupulous, you know, the everything was wound just a little too tight. Now it's like everything is like way loose and coming apart. Especially in a spiritually lax age, that's kind of hard to hear. But please remember that in the early church, they did not have a regular system. I mean, it's one of the things that explains the kind of slow development of confession. The kind of slow development. What you tend to see in the early church are Christians who do fall into serious sin. And what happens? There's public penance. They're like publicly, I mean, the whole discipline of Lent, goes back to this period in the early church where if you were a known murderer, adulterer, you fell back into idolatry, you know, you had some sort of public sin, you know, thievery or whatnot, there was going to be this 40-day period where you were literally in sackcloth and ashes. I mean, you took your, you know, took the ashes and spread them in your hair. I tell this to him because we just read Jonah, and you know, the, where they fast for 40 days. And I talk about now many of you, you know, you have cream rinse and your shampoo and you've got your combs and your brushes, and you spend a lot of time on this. Oh, you ladies too. Sometimes they pick up on that, sometimes they don't. Anyway, so they're sackcloth. Many of the students, by the way, they don't know what sackcloth is. Some of them know what burlap is, so you can work from that. But you were in things that signaled that you, that as a known sinner, as a, you know, like everybody, remember, these are small communities. Everybody knows what you do. So you would, for the first period, you would got to be outside the church, but you weren't allowed to come in. And you would be outside the church asking for people to pray for you as they would come in. Later stages, you would be allowed to come in, but you wouldn't be allowed to go in the main body of the church. In the third stage, you'd be allowed to go in the main body of the church, but you would have to, but you wouldn't be able to be there for the whole thing. So once you got to the offertory, generally with the offertory, that's when the people who were not really in and really kind of serious and regularly practicing their faith, that's when they left. Okay, and in that last stage, at Easter, that's when you were fully reconciled to the church. So the confessional, like you've got a box, you know, you got a grill, and you come in on one side and say your sins, and okay, for your penance, say one Our Father and five Hail Marys. Now make a good act of contrition. That, remember, that box doesn't come into being until the 1400s. Okay, all this was like face-to-face confession. In the Eastern Orthodox, they take the stole and they put it over you. You know, in the Eastern Catholic and Eastern Orthodox, is the priest takes a stole and puts it over you when you're forgiven. So it was very, very different. But in that early church, you're talking about public forms of penance. So in other words, when you think about the power of the church binding and loosening, it's as if the emphasis on the church in the early church is more on the binding part. And then after about 500 or 600 years, then it's more on the loosening part. But the expectation in the early church is you're a Christian, you're a saint. And that's more understandable in an age where if you're a Christian, you're putting yourself in physical danger. Remember, this is an under first 300-400 years of Christianity, this is an underground church. You've got some steel in the spine if you're going to be a Christian. I will say this, Pope John Paul II, during his papacy, he would talk about how it is that we have to recover the idea that in baptism, you are asking God to give you the graces to make you a saint. We can't just have some kind of settling for a mediocre, you know, piety or mediocre religion. It's as if, you know, to use the academic language, sanctity would be like AP or honors Christianity, and I'm just signing up for regular. I'm just regular Christianity here. Don't want any extra assignments. Don't want any extra, you know, anything. Can I do this? Like, just pass. And that's what John Paul II was always very vocal about coming out of the Second Vatican Council, where in Lumen Gentium there's this emphasis on the universal call to holiness. Everybody is called to be holy, and so when we see the language of saints, this is a long way of answering your question, but when we see that language of saints, that's what Christians are supposed to be. That's regular. That's not like AP or honors. And every Christian should be able to look at their own life and see a kind of a dividing line. There should be some kind of, unless you're a very remarkable person that just early on in your young life, you embraced the faith, you embraced it completely, and it's been going good ever since. For most of us, there's some kind of dividing line that you should be able to see. That, you know, this is where really, I sort of belong to the world. I sort of went with the world. I sort of went with the flow. And at some point, God called me to something higher and better. And to be able to renew that in your own mind, to be able to say, no, I left this behind for good. Right? I left this behind for good. Remember when our Lord points to the example of Lot's wife. You know, it's one of the shortest verses, just like Jesus wept. Remember Lot's wife. Okay? It's not like she turned around and she was just curious. I've never seen a city destroyed by fire and brimstone before. Oh, I just have to look. It isn't just mere curiosity that's the problem. In a way, what she was doing was looking back to the life she left behind. You know, I miss that. I'm going in this direction and I'm just kind of going along. I really, you know, what was she thinking? I miss anthropology. I miss the stores. I miss the malls in Sodom. You know, great restaurant. Oh, there were some really fine restaurants in Sodom. You know, what is it? But there was something about that, that in looking back, you know, that's why she ends up as a pillar of salt. It's not just curiosity. So the exhortation that you see in Ephesians, it's not just you're believing something now you didn't believe before. No, you're entering into a supernatural life. So let me end with this image from St. Gregory. You'll notice there are 9 choirs of angels. And St. Gregory will say that through Christ and through the Incarnation and through the Church, we become like the 10th. We become like this 10th in this hierarchy. So we fill up sort of what's missing or what's incomplete. There are other church fathers who will talk about how it is that, in a way, the salvation of human beings, we are making up for the fall of the wicked angels. That, if you like, the wicked angels leave places open that God in His mercy wants filled, so that we are filling up what is missing. Go ahead, Mrs. Bettina.
Can you refer us to something we could read from the church fathers? Like, is there a particular...
Well, here's one thing that a lot... So the Thomas Aquinas, that's an easy one because that's online. But what I'll do is I'll send the link to Jonas. You can send it to you. The problem with this is there are a lot of really fine things in this homily. The problem is it's not online, and I got it from getting this book out of interlibrary loan. I had to get it from interlibrary loan to get the book. There are these wonderful things in St. Gregory, but they're not in the Antoninus St. Fathers like we have in the library here. But I can, the things that I'm talking about in terms of the governance of the angels, the hierarchy of the angels, the name of the angels, a lot of those things are in St. Thomas. I'd be happy to send you the link for those. Very good. So next week we'll be doing chapters 3 and 4. Chapters 3 and 4.
Homily today was on Ephesians 4, but that kind of thing.
Oh.
Go to the St. Gregory Hills website.